the Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, May 11th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Robin Hemley, author of the new book Do-Over, in which a 48-year-old father of three returns to kindergarten, summer camp, the prom, and other embarrassments. Robin Hemley is the winner of a Guggenheim Fellowship for his work on Do-Over. He has published 7 books, and his stories and essays have appeared in the New York Times, New York Magazine, Chicago Tribune, and many literary magazines and anthologies. Robin received his MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He currently directs the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa and lives in Iowa City. I spoke to Robin by phone last week. I first asked how he had the idea to write Do-Over.
Well, I was sitting with some students at a local watering hole in Iowa City. We have a once-a-month, or we used to have a once-a-month pitch session with my graduate students in the nonfiction writing program. Where the people who are interested in literary journalism would get together and just shoot ideas back and forth and see what worked. And I had an idea one night. I don't know exactly where it came from, but I just said, you know, I think it would be fun if I went back to summer camp, not as a counselor, but as a camper. And they really loved the idea. So I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a shot. And so I sent a pitch to someone at a major magazine who I was acquainted with, and he said, you know, this seems like a good idea. It even seems like something we'd do, but we're going to pass. Didn't give me any further explanation, but that's the way these things go. So I then had a correspondence with an editor at New York Magazine, and I pitched the idea to her. The camp that I'd gone to was in New York, so she said, you know, I love the idea, but we'll only do it if you can get the camp on board. Mm-hmm. So I called the camp, and I explained the situation to them, said, you know, New York Magazine's interested. And they said, well, this sounds like a fun idea. We would be willing to do it, but of course we'll have to give you a background check and all of that. And I said, of course, you know. So I passed the background check, luckily, and I went to the camp and had a great time, and I wrote the article for New York. This was in August of 2006. It was called Big Man on Camp, and as I was writing the article, I had a very short turnaround, just 2 or 3 days. I wrote the article in a friend's house on the Jersey Shore that he lent me, and I wrote it and in a very short time. And one night we were having dinner, and I said, you know, I could do a whole book of these. I really enjoyed this. And so I had that idea to do a book, and I just wrote down possible do-overs. And in a matter of about 5 minutes, I'd come up with 10 of them. And that's how the book started.
One thing I loved about this book is it's not just like you wrote about those things you would have liked to have done over, but that you actually went back and redid all of these events in your life. I thought it was great. I was wondering if it was at all an awkward project for you, walking into each situation.
Oh, absolutely. And the first hour was just terrifying in almost each do-over because, you know, it was like having jitters the first day of class, you know. When I went into kindergarten, I just was terrified because here I was, you know, a 48-year-old man standing in a lunch line with 5-year-olds. And I thought, this is going to be embarrassing, you know. And who knows how they're going to accept me. And you know, kids might make fun of me. All these, you know, demons from your childhood come back to you. But within about an hour, everyone, including myself, especially myself, settled down and went with the sort of rhythm of the week. And then didn't feel awkward.
I would think 5-year-olds might be the most open-minded group of all the kids that you were in situations with.
Very open-minded. I mean, it was surprising because, you know, I live in a college town, and the teachers and the principal thought, well, you know, they'll probably treat you like they treat any observers from the education department, because they get adults in there all the time. But to everyone's surprise, including mine, the kids accepted me not as a five-year-old, but as a kindergartner, because they'd been told I'd had a bad kindergarten experience and I was going back to have a better kindergarten experience, and that was explanation enough for them. So, you know, on the first day, one of the kids said to me, so who's picking you up after school? And I said, my wife, and they all kind of looked at me blankly, and one of them said, oh, I thought you were going to say your dad. So they really accepted me as a kindergartner.
That's great. Were you surprised that people allowed you access into each of these situations?
Well, I was very fortunate in that in each case, you know, the doors opened eventually. There were a lot of logistics involved. You know, you can't just say, hey, I want to go back to kindergarten for a week. You know, you really have to, in some cases, you know, I had to send letters to all the parents and explain my project and, you know, get clearances and so on. But it went really smoothly for the most part.
I would think having New York Magazine behind you from that first camp probably helped a lot.
Yeah, that helped a lot. Having New York Magazine behind me, I mean, I feel like I owe them a lot, because without that first approval, I don't think it would have been easy at all.
Right.
Some of these do-overs were really hard. A few of them one of them that I wanted to do was to live in an old childhood home again.
Right.
And you know, can you imagine getting a letter from a stranger saying, hi, can I live with you for a week? You know, that doesn't sit well with most people. So I had to figure out a way that they wouldn't just think I was a crank. So luckily I had the New York Magazine article, and I thought, well, you know, what would get their attention and make them not think that this is junk mail? Because I didn't have any of their names. I just had the old addresses. So I put everything I FedExed everything. I figured people would open a FedEx envelope. So I FedExed everything. I put my New York Magazine article in the FedEx. I wrote my letter on official University of Iowa stationery. And I just waited, and I got one nibble from one of my old houses, and the woman even actually miraculously knew some of my old childhood friends. But she just was too, she or some family members were just too creeped out by the notion of this and just weren't interested. And I actually gave up on it, and then about 5 months into the project, 5 or 6 months, I got a letter from an email from someone in South Bend, where I had lived, South Bend, Indiana. And she said, you know, this sounds like a fun project. I'm an academic myself, and in the spirit of collegiality, I'll open my house to you as long as you keep me anonymous. And so I lived up to that, and it was great.
Yeah. Now, that's the house that you lived in when your sister passed away.
It is.
Did that bring back just even more stuff for you than any other, I would think, of these do-overs?
Well, they all brought up a lot, but yes, that certainly being in that house was, you know, a pretty moving experience. Again, by complete coincidence, the person who now owns the house happened to know the sister of one of my mother's best friends, and my mother had passed away in 2004. And so before I knew it, she had organized, the owner of the house had organized a dinner for me at the house with my mother's, with a cadre of close friends in South Bend, which was just amazing.
Wow.
And really, really made the experience very strong for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what, Robin, maybe this would be a good time for you to read from Do-Over.
Sure. Well, I think what I want to read from is my eighth grade Do-Over chapter.
Okay.
I went back to to my old junior high in Columbia, Missouri, Jefferson Junior High. And eighth grade was just, I hated eighth grade. I don't know many people who love eighth grade. but anyway, so I thought this was a tough one because I really didn't like eighth grade, but I loved the do-over. And I'll just say one other thing, just in case people are curious. I changed all of the names of the kids and many of the adult names, too.
And the other thing I was going to mention for anybody who hasn't read the book yet is just that you moved a lot. I mean, all of these do-overs take place in different towns, largely because you moved around so much as a kid, correct?
Right, right, I did. Yeah, my father died when I was 7, and he had moved us from New York to Athens, Ohio. And then we moved, after his death, to Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania for a year, and then Columbia, Missouri, and on and on. You know, so we were moving around a lot. Yeah, so I'm going to read from PE class, where I went to PE class and had to do flag football, which just completely mortified me. So here's the scene in the middle of one of my days.
Okay.
The coach tells us we're going to play flag football today. This is the worst news, like a death sentence for me. What good could possibly come of a 48-year-old playing flag football with 13 and 14-year-olds? I don't have time to ponder this because we head out of the locker room and cross the street to the track and playing fields. Unfortunately, it's a beautiful spring day, sunny and warm and no chance of rain. But I rally as the coach tells us to do 4 laps, and I forget my age. I am Robin the fleet-footed as I run my laps, hardly getting winded at all, passing eighth graders right and left. I'm not the fastest, but I'm not the slowest by a long shot, something I couldn't say my first time on this track when Coach Adams timed me as the slowest of all eighth graders in the 100-yard dash. Today, I even have the hope that PE might not be a complete disaster. As we're doing warm-up stretches, a breeze catches a loose page from my notebook and sends it skittering across the field. I run after it and wind up on the edge of the playing field on a slight rise above the sidewalk where 4 girls and their teacher, all dressed in gym clothes, are walking toward the school. "Ooh, what's that?" one of the girls says, pointing at me. "Dude, who are you?" says another. I just wave. I don't have time to explain I'm some fool in gym clothes. They can see that for themselves. The coach has us stand in line and count off in teams of 6. When I see my team and the opposing team, I realize that fate does not want me to have a good day in gym class. 2 of the opposing players are actually first-string players on the Jefferson Junior High football team, burly guys who look older than me and are bigger than I am. My team is a casting call for Winnie the Pooh. There's a pot-bellied, big-butted boy named Stanley who is Eeyore personified. He wears a Columbia Fire Department T-shirt, but other than that, he is invisible. He is the kid to whom no one will ever pass the ball. The coach has told us that everyone should get his hands on the ball, but we know that's a remark with an asterisk. Except for that kid is unstated, but floats an inch above awareness. We would give him the ball. I would. But he will become invisible as soon as the game starts. There's also a tall kid named Roger, a gazelle of a boy, which in itself would bode well for us, except that he looks as odd as I was at his age. He stands completely straight, rigid in fact, even as he runs, his arms to his sides. If he does not lift his arms, it's unlikely he's going to pass or catch a football. Another boy looks fit enough but has the nickname Banana, which doesn't strike me as promising. Then there's red-headed Harry, who wears glasses and has an ironic detachment that is likewise not well-suited for football. There's only one possible player among us, a small, swift boy from Sri Lanka named Baba. It's like some classic Hollywood moment, the team from the 100-acre wood facing the Chicago Bears. What's a Pooh Bear to do? Within the first 30 seconds, the opposing team scores a touchdown and most of our team slackens. Still, Baba, our quarterback, can run and pass, and I tell him he should pass to me. The next play, he does just that. I leap to catch the ball, and it's intercepted. The player who scored the first touchdown scores another. Baba doesn't show any emotion, but I feel pretty bad letting everyone down like that. A few plays later, Baba runs the ball for a touchdown. When Baba throws me another pass, I catch it this time and manage to make some yardage. Several plays later, I stop one of the opposing players, who at 6'2 stands an inch taller than me, from scoring on the third down. A miracle happens. The boy who will not lift his arms suddenly does so, and into his arms the football flies. He scores a touchdown easily, just to show that it can be done, I assume. Then he resumes his stance of geeky boredom. The other team wipes the field with us, but I've managed to redeem myself a little. The final score is 28-14. On our way back to the locker room, Stanley suddenly materializes beside us. I seem to recall everyone gets the ball, he states in a tone both bitter and apathetic. I didn't get it once. No one bothers to reply, as he's simply stating the obvious. Welcome to eighth grade, Stanley. Make any touchdowns? Coach asks me back in the locker room. No. As a matter of fact, I had the ball intercepted, I tell him, still stinging with that old feeling of athletic failure. Stanley and I are brethren, really. Tell you what, he says. I admire you for getting in there. You don't see me out on that field.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
So I should say that was Robin Hemley reading from his new book, Do-Over, published by Little Brown. I was curious, how real were the details about all these people? I know you changed the names of the kids and some of the adults. Did you change anything else?
You know, I changed certain details, but I didn't change everything. You know, there were certain things I left, but yeah, I mean, I changed certain details when it seemed appropriate.
Are they going to recognize themselves in this?
Some will. I mean, some, you know, it's unavoidable that some people will probably, yeah, you know, recognize themselves. But you know, I definitely changed the names and did what I could.
Right, right. I remember that you mentioned at one point in a gym class, I don't remember if it was eighth grade, where your notes flew out of your hand and you had to kind of run and catch them. And I was wondering, were you taking notes throughout when you were doing the do-overs? Were you?
I was. I was taking notes. I had to, because my memory's not so great always, you know, so I have to. So I always carried around a little pocket journal. And, you know, it's like a photographer with a camera. At first, people are very self-conscious, but eventually the camera becomes part of the background. And I think there's always the possibility that people will be playing to it a little bit, but, or, you know, knowing that I'm a writer, but for the most part, that didn't happen that much. I mean, I put away the notebook when I could, but I just took notes partly to jog my memory later on. And it was a curious experience for me, because it was as though I was both sort of experiencing these events in three different ways. I was remembering the original time when I was a child, and I was also obviously there, you know, playing flag football. But then I was also conscious of being a writer too, you know, trying to record things.
Right. Along those same lines, as far as living it in three different ways, you quote Anais Nin at one point in your book. I loved this quote. She says, we do not grow absolutely chronologically. We grow sometimes in one dimension and not in another, unevenly. We grow partially. We are relative. We are mature in one realm, childish in another. The past, present, and future mingle and pull us backward, forward, or fix us in the present. We are made up of layers, cells, constellations. I loved that.
That was a great quote. I have to thank my friend Anastasia Fonts of the Split Rock Writers Conference or Artist Conference in Minnesota. She was welcoming us. I was teaching there one summer, and she was welcoming us, and she just started off the conference by reading that quote, and I just thought, so great. I said, oh, Anastasia, I'm going to take that quote for my book. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
it fits so beautifully. So, you know, sometimes you get these things just by being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. With that quote in mind, I'm wondering if you found yourself at all taken by surprise by the strength of your own past insecurities coming back during these do-overs. You know, did they haunt you constantly or less than you might have expected?
No, I'd say they didn't haunt me constantly, but they definitely cropped up. And, you know, that was part of the reason for doing the book, to sort of confront these old things that had in some ways been impediments in my life. It just, you know, because some of these things you never know what's going to be trivial to one person or, you know, really monumental to someone else. But you carry all these things inside you and these insecurities and fears and whatever. And so when I started the book, I actually thought, well, this is going to be kind of a lark. This is just going to be fun. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun. But I was surprised sometimes, really surprised by the force of emotion when I'd be doing something and suddenly something would just bowl me over, you know, some memory or something I thought, you know, about my daughters, because the book's also not just about my past, but it's about being a parent, and it's about my daughters from my first marriage and my current marriage. So, yeah, a lot of things. You can't write a book that, or you can, but you're not going to write a book that's very, that means much to you or anyone else if it's something that in which you don't actually have some emotional stake in it.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned your marriage. I'm wondering how trying was this experience for your wife, Margie?
Well, she's, you know, the dedication to the book, I think, says it all. When I was thinking of how I would dedicate it, I wrote for Margie, who in marrying a writer didn't quite know what she was in for. And, you know, I think, you know, people who marry writers, I feel a little sorry for them because, you know, we're a trying lot. But you know, there was truth in advertising when we married. I told her, you know, that I'm a writer and there are certain things that we do, like write about our families. And she's, you know, wonderfully supportive and has a great sense of humor. And so, you know, there were things that might have made her uncomfortable at first, but she's, you know, read the book and given it her seal of approval.
I thought she was being a real trooper.
She was. I was being very childish for some reason throughout the book. And, you know, she was great. You know, there's one scene where, you know, she's pregnant and I make her do a test about, you know, what your eighth graders likes and dislikes. And she was going through morning sickness while I was doing this. And I finally woke up to the fact that this is probably a little weird. I shouldn't do this. So I stopped, you know. But yeah, she was great throughout the project.
I also, I really appreciated seeing our culture through the eyes of this adult going back and doing these things as a kid, if that makes any sense. I really loved in the section called The Year of Bullies when you return to sixth grade and during recess you're playing a game of zombie with other kids and you're finally getting into this group of kids and having fun, and a playground lady starts shouting at your group for using pretend weapons, and it was so funny to me.
Yeah, that was pretty funny too. I felt embarrassed, of course, you know. I thought, oh, of course, you know, they don't allow this anymore. But when I was a kid, and I didn't start it, you know, they were all having fun, and so they wanted me to, you know, play with them, and it completely seemed harmless, and we were just having a lot of fun, and then we were, you know, awakened to the call of, you know, current life in America by the playground lady, and
right.
told we couldn't do this.
I also really enjoyed the moment in which you extend the following thought that you saw on a poster at Jefferson Junior High School, where you redid eighth grade. The sign read, "Good things happen to people who try," and you write, "Maybe, maybe not, but for today, let's take it for gospel. Let's say we have our whole lives left to try." I was wondering if that was sort of something you wanted readers to take away from this whole book.
Unfortunately, good things don't always happen to people who try, but we do want to believe that. And we have to believe it as we go through our lives, because, you know, otherwise you don't know, you know, what the struggle is for. So you do have to sort of buck up and make it through these, you know, whatever, you know, trials, you know, you're going through. So it's something that I definitely believe. And when I saw that sign, I thought, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting. I don't know if I believe it right now, but I do think at least you have your whole life ahead of you to try to make, you know, positive things happen.
Right, or to try to please yourself about who you are. Or...
Exactly, yeah, that's even better, yeah, how to please yourself, because I think that's the most important thing, obviously.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about writing in general, if I could. You run the nonfiction writing program at Iowa, and obviously you teach, and you have a family, and you seem to be a fairly prolific writer. I'm just curious how you structure your time.
Well, like most writers, I'm fairly obsessive when I'm in a project. I tend to be all over the map, literally. I travel a lot. I tend to be all over the map during any given day. I really have a running motor. I can't sit still. It's amazing that I've written any books, you know. But when an idea really grabs hold, then I'm pretty much, you know, that's all I do is write. And I try to be, you know, a good dad. I try to be a good husband. I try to do all the other things in life as well. And I really enjoy each of my roles that I've, you know, constructed in my life. But I don't always give each one equal weight every day, you know, because it's impossible.
Right. So when you're in the middle of a project, do you write at a certain time of the day? Are you structured as far as time goes? Or
I like to write in the morning. The mornings are the best. When I was in graduate school, you know, I had these romantic notions of writing, and I would stay up all night and write a draft. And, you know, I really felt like I had to write things in one sitting and stay up all night. And it was a very romantic and tiring notion, you know. It wasn't something that could be sustained. And I read a wonderful book around this time by Dorothea Brand called Becoming a Writer. It was published originally in the 30s, and John Gardner wrote a foreword to it. And I read it, and she talked about the regularity of writing, of getting up every morning and writing and making it a habit, and just how to train your subconscious to accept your need to write. And so I really took that to heart and started following that advice, and it really helped me a lot. So I try very hard to write regularly.
Yeah.
You know, Graham Greene wrote 500 words a day. That was what he wrote, 500 words. And, you know, look, he became Graham Greene, you know.
On 500 words a day.
Yeah.
That's my
next self-help book, Become Graham Greene on 500 words a day.
Do you tend to write one thing at a time, or do you go back and forth between projects?
Well, I find that it's best for me to stay focused when I'm working on one thing, to stay with it. Because if I flip back and forth, then my commitment can waver to the project, which makes it harder sometimes for longer projects, because I do a lot of different kinds of writing, and some of it is short. I do these, I'm doing these dispatches from Manila for McSweeney's Internet Tendency, and they're just 1,500-word pieces that I write, and they're very satisfying for me to write, but I'm also trying to work on a longer project, and it's hard to sometimes go away and then come back and go away and come back.
Right. You also have a blog on your website, and before I forget, I want to mention what your website is. It's robinhemley.com, and your name is Robinhemley. So you have a blog on your website, and I wanted to talk about that. I'm curious, when you keep a blog, do you ever find yourself feeling like, why am I wasting these pearls of wisdom in my blog? I could be doing something that will get published. Does that...
Right, right. Well, initially, I had that feeling. I didn't also like the amount of what felt like self-absorption that needed to be sort of directed towards a blog. Obviously, people sometimes accuse memoir writers of being too self-absorbed to begin with, or writers in general. But I don't think that's actually necessarily the case. But with the blog, I quickly found that it could be a resource too. There are certain things that I could share with people that were not just about me and just about my book and buy my book, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So of course, I wanted people to buy the book, but I also wanted to give people something useful. So I started sharing book tour disaster stories.
Those have been really fun to read.
Yeah, I've enjoyed. I sent out a call to my writer friends and said, look, we've all had disasters while giving readings or whatever, and I think it would be fun and just sort of myth-busting in some ways to put up some of these. And so, I've had some hilarious episodes. One person, Michael Malone, wrote about someone, sort of a dark humor piece, but he arrived at a reading to find it cordoned off because an elderly woman had passed away in the audience before there was even an audience, so he couldn't give the reading, And then another person had one person in his audience, and then the audience was arrested by the police because he was just there to avoid the police, and the police found him, so they arrested his audience. In another one, in my case, I gave a reading at Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle from my book Turning Life into Fiction back in the early 90s, and it was admittedly not a good reading. I was nervous or something, and the audience trickled out after the reading, except for one woman who came up to me. I thought, it wasn't completely terrible, and it turned out to be a lawyer serving me with a subpoena for a case that I shouldn't have even been involved in, but I was a material witness. But so I was served a subpoena at my own reading. So those kinds of things. They're a lot of fun.
That's really funny. So if people are listening to this and they have nightmare stories about readings, should they send them to you?
Yeah, please, by all means. I love them.
Yeah. You mentioned the McSweeney's internet tendency. I wanted to just ask you about a recent article that you wrote from your dispatches from Manila called The Great Book Blockade of 2009. It sounds like it's getting a lot of reaction.
It's been great. I had a Guggenheim Fellowship this past year, and I spent the year in the Philippines with my family. My wife's from the Philippines, and we decided to go there. And so I've been doing these dispatches from Manila, and one of the things that happened in early, February, I learned that the Philippines was breaking an international treaty that says that imported books cannot be taxed, or that there can't be duty put on them, and the Customs in the Philippines, the Philippines Customs Department, decided to ignore this and to start imposing duties. And so they basically, in my mind, extorted the booksellers and importers and held their shipments for 2 months for ransom, basically, and said, you have to pay duty or we're going to hold these. And meanwhile, these ridiculously large storage fees accrued. And finally, the importers and booksellers had to give in, had to capitulate. And I was just outraged by this. I thought, this is terrible. How could this happen? And no one was writing about it. So I decided to write about it for McSweeney's. And boy, it immediately caught fire in the Philippines and in the U.S. too. It's all over the blogosphere in the Philippines. The Philippine Inquirer, Manuel Quezon III, did a column on it. And now there's a Facebook cause, Filipinos Against Book Taxation or something to that effect, that was just started yesterday, I believe, and it already has well over 1,000 members.
Wow.
And so people are really up in arms about this, and I'm really glad about it because, I think that that sometimes a little publicity can have the right effect, and maybe start a grassroots movement to mm-hmm. to call corrupt officials on their shenanigans.
Right, and you've said that the Philippines is a really very corrupt government. Is that?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, there's institutionalized corruption and there's personal corruption, but the Philippines always consistently ranks near the top of corrupt countries year after year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful country. The people are wonderful, but the government is, leaves a lot to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, I always say that, we have our own forms of corruption, have our own sins to deal with, but I was over there and I, love the Philippines and feel I'm married into the culture, and so I felt, this was something I needed to bring to people's attention.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you're working on now, Robin.
Well, I'm working on not biting my nails to the quick over the reception of Do-Over. It comes out in just a couple of days,
right.
Few days. So that's one thing. But the other thing, in terms of my my writing, I'm really at the moment taking notes and writing something longer that I don't want to really discuss right now, just because
okay.
I don't want to jinx it. But
sure.
But I've been writing a lot of essays and a lot of shorter things this year. Yeah.
Can you say if the longer thing is going to be fiction or nonfiction?
Well, right now, yeah, it's going to be fiction.
Okay. All right. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what writers have influenced you, either personally or through reading their works.
Well, my parents were both writers, and my mother certainly, she was a short story writer, Elaine Gottlieb Hemley, and she was probably the most important influence in getting me writing young. And my tastes were often her tastes. I loved a lot of the sort of the writers who were more speculative. I mean, I've always loved Borges.
Mm-hmm.
I've loved Kafka. I've loved. But I have very eclectic reading tastes, and I think I'm a fairly eclectic writer, too. I write in a lot of different modes. The writer, the Russian-Jewish writer Isaac Babel, these are people I discovered in my family's library, when I was in my teens. And they, those early discoveries are often the ones that really stay with you. Over your life. Now, I don't know that anyone could ever discern Kafka or Borges or Isaac Babel necessarily in my fiction or nonfiction. I don't know, but they were inspirations to me. And then my teacher at Iowa, Barry Hanna, was a wonderfully generous teacher. And we're probably nothing alike as writers, maybe not even as human beings. But I just really connected with him in graduate school. And I think as a writer, it's just wonderful to have, one or two supportive people, and then two or three, of course, many books that you're inspired by, but those books that really make you want to write.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, of course, I changed. I also loved, in high school, I started reading Kurt Vonnegut. I loved him. Okay. I've always loved kind of absurdist writers. I've loved Grace Paley. I was thinking today, this morning, about how much I love Grace Paley and Studs Terkel, as much for their social activism as for their writing. I mean, I love both of their writings, but and you know, I was sad that you know that both of them have passed away recently. But I've always admired them tremendously as human beings, because they're people who didn't just sit in their rooms all day, but got out in the world and did what you know needed to be done to change the world in other ways.
Yeah, yeah. What are you reading right now?
Right now, I'm actually reading a mammoth history of Australia that was published in the 1980s. It's a wonderful book called The Fatal Shore,
sure,
the epic of Australia's founding by Robert Hughes, who is probably best known as an art critic, but he's also Australian. And he came out with this book in the 1980s, and it was a bestseller, and I always wanted to read it. And my excuse now is that I'm going to Australia later this summer. I'm taking a group of students there for a writing workshop, and I've assigned the book to everyone. So it's a mammoth book, and it's wonderful, and it's really riveting, and you know, so I'm deeply into that.
What group of students is it from? University of Iowa or
mostly. Mostly they're University of Iowa students. I have something every summer called the Overseas Writing Workshop. It's open to other students from other programs, too. And we have had students from Columbia and elsewhere. You know, it's definitely open to students everywhere. Next year we're going to the island of Corfu in Greece, which should be great. We're going to have four different workshops, one in poetry, one in nonfiction, one in translation, and one in fiction.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. So my last question for writers is always the same, and that is, what advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward? Do you have any exercises or activities that you turn to, or what do you personally do or recommend?
Well, I have a couple things. First of all, I think as far as writer's block goes, that sometimes it's just this fear of failure or being a perfectionist or whatever. And I always like the poet William Stafford's advice when he was asked about writer's block. They said, what do you do for writer's block? And he said, lower your standards. And I think that's really good advice, you know. So and allow yourself to fail. But as far as exercises go, one of the exercises I like is to imagine the first kitchen that you remember, to close your eyes and to spend about 15 minutes taking a kind of mental tour of the first kitchen you remember, going through the cupboards, the refrigerator, seeing the sink, what the ceiling looks like, the floor, seeing what people are in the kitchen, what kind of conversations, what smells, all of that. And doing it slowly. It's best, I do that often with a group, and I walk around, have them all close their eyes and give them prompts. And they come up with some amazing stuff. I mean, it's a wonderful memory exercise. Another one is one that that I heard about a number of years ago. The writer E.L. Doctorow was stuck one day. He was in the attic of the house he had recently purchased, and he was working on a novel he was under contract for, and he just couldn't progress with it. So he set it aside, and he decided as an exercise that he would imagine the original inhabitants of the house. It was built in the turn of the 20th century. And he would imagine who they were, and he started writing, and he didn't stop for about 300 pages. It became a novel, his most famous novel, Ragtime, it all stemmed from an exercise. So I always sort of honor the idea of exercises. I think if you're stuck, you know, try an exercise, do something like that, and see what happens. So just enjoy it. You know, do something that you. I mean, I don't think you should necessarily give up and flit from one project to another, but I think sometimes it's worth taking the pressure off and doing something that will ease your subconscious, as it were.
Right. And I would think that kitchen exercise could be worked into just about anything else you're writing. What book doesn't have a kitchen in it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Just even for the details, just taking the details of, you know, an old Folgers coffee can with grease, bacon grease poured in it, something like that. You know, just little details like that will help you a lot. I always find, you know, our minds are so associative that one thing always leads to another. And if you just allow yourself not to be sort of straitjacketed into whatever narrative you're trying to construct, then I think eventually you're going to break through.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. That's wonderful advice.
Well, my pleasure.
Well, so Robin, that's it. And thank you so much for talking to me. This was great.
Oh, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Robin Hemley. Before I move forward, I want to repeat his website for you. It's robinhemley.com. Next week, please tune in again to hear a conversation with author Jim DeFilippi. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Robin Hemley, who has had great success using this exercise in his classes. Write about the first kitchen you can remember. Close your eyes, spend about 15 minutes taking a mental tour. Go through the cupboards and the refrigerator. See the sink. Look at the ceiling and the floor. What people can you recall seeing in that kitchen? What conversations did you hear or take part in? What smells do you remember? Do this slowly. If at all possible, consider trying this exercise in a group. Nominate someone to offer prompts to the others, working slowly and helping them to think of those not quite lost bits of memory that might send you in a new direction or enrich whatever you are already working on. And if you're really stuck, remember the advice of William Stafford. What do you do if you get writer's block? Lower your standards. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned for more great Radiator music. Cheryl Willoughby and the World of Music will be back next week. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.